Well, in 2 Kings 10, we have Jehu who goes around killing a whole bunch. And then now in chapter 11, after he's dead, we come to a woman who kills a bunch and is her own kinfolk. Chapter 11 of 2 Kings at verse 1. When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the royal heirs. We'll have an occasion, I hope, to reference 2 Chronicles 24 a little later that will go into more detail about some of these things, but she's killing her grandchildren. This is the family of David, and it's one of two times where the family of David gets down to one male member, and yet God's promise through David has not been jeopardized or compromised or even threatened, because he will keep his promise. The first verse shows us that when Athaliah is introduced, seeing that her son is dead, we realize now we have a Jezebel, not in Israel, as the real Jezebel had been, but a Jezebel in Judah itself. She is as ruthless as Jezebel was. I don't know if Jezebel was her mother or she's just the daughter of Ahab. It doesn't say, as far as I know. But she killed her grandchildren. And we know that in verse 2, Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash. Why she chose this one and only one, and is this the only one she could get? I don't know. I'd love to know those details. But she managed to rescue one. She stole him away from among the king's sons who were being murdered. And they hid him and his nurse in the bedroom from Athaliah so that he was not killed. So he was hidden with her in the house of the Lord for 6 years while Athaliah reigned over the land. If you want to talk about circumstances, I don't know what was being done. Did she order men, soldiers under her control to come in and slit their throats, kill them, throw them off the balcony or something? I don't know. Did she do it herself? And did she poison them, make it look like it was a natural death? Who knows? Nobody knows any of these things. We just know when all was said and done, either with her own hands or by authorized agents, she was able to murder her own grandchildren. That takes a pretty heartless person to do so. We're told in verse 1, she destroyed all the royal heirs. Verse 2 shows there's one exception. How it happened that he escaped, we don't know. In the providence of God, it did. There was no way this boy could have been killed. If he had been killed, what would have been the consequence? The promise of God would have fallen. And that's not going to happen. So he is spared. Did they overlook him? Did they forget that he was there as they came in and got several of them and she hid him away in between their trips to take them? I have no idea. I'd love to know those things. But I would not have loved to see what was going on. That would have been an atrocity, the like of which we would never be able to recover. Now, in verse 1, we might note that Athaliah didn't mourn her son's death. In fact, she not only doesn't mourn his death, she gets busy doing what is really important in her life, and that is securing the number one position in the land of Judah. And so what you see here, her son is now out of the way. She destroys the grandchildren. They're rivals to her for the throne. She is idolatrous and power hungry. And she's willing to do whatever it takes. You hear about politicians who are so ruthless, they would run over their grandmother in order to be elected. She's willing to kill her grandchildren. It doesn't get worse than this. Today, we have occasions where people abort babies. We have occasions where they abort them after they're born, even now. It's absolutely incredible and sickening. And it all gets down to, in many cases, autonomy, self-rule. I don't have to care for some crying infant. I don't want to have the responsibility, so I'll just kill it. It's not a person anyway. I don't know at what point it becomes one. But that's similar to the arguments that are being made here. And the slaughter in this case is that it's not one person killing several. It's many killing one here and one there and adds up to multiplied millions over a period of time. If she was allowed her way, she would end the house of David. If you could talk to this woman, and ask her, what do you think about God's promise to David? And she'd say, whose promise to whom? She didn't know the true God. She certainly doesn't know David unless it's by reputation and in the way some have talked about him. But would she hesitate for a second to kill the only living heir to David and thus nullify the promise of God? No, it wouldn't even slow her down. It wouldn't even slow her down. She would kill him in a heartbeat all these 6 years that she's seated on the throne. So, if you look at this from the standpoint of animals, we know there are occasions where animals can act very ruthlessly. A male polar bear will sometimes attack its young and try to kill them, and the mother will try to fight him off and prevent that. But usually in the animal kingdom, it's not that way. It's with sophisticated people that it is that way, and it's very sad this is so. But in verse 2, Jehosheba, the hero, the heroine of the plot, shows that she's the one, the sister of Ahaziah, who has died, her son, her brother has died, the son of Athaliah, the daughter of King Joram. She has saved Ahaziah's son, Joash. She hid him and his nurse from his own grandmother. She stole him away. Now, she didn't steal him. She saved him, but she whisked him away so that he would be able to live. She is like the woman of 2 Kings 4. You remember how the woman was described, the woman who would take care of Elijah when he would visit? And she had a room there with a table and chair and bed and lamp. What do you call her? What kind of woman? Say? Yeah, what her character? What word describes her character? She was a great woman. I would have to say here's number two, if there are not some others. I don't know anything else about this woman, but she gets my vote for number two at least, as being a great woman. Now, as you look at Jehosheba, the heroine of this plot, you'll notice that here's a case where you have a hiding place for a young king. The hiding place here that she puts him in, we're told in verse 2, it's the same as in chapter 9, verse 2, a place where they go into Anat Jehu. It's a place where people would go and discuss their plans, like Ben-Hadad. And he was told that if you go to this room, Elisha is going to know what you're saying in your bedchamber. It's that kind of private place that she puts him in. So she not only rescues him, but she has now the responsibility to save him from her wrath in these 6 or so years that she's reigning as queen over Judah. Now, as you look further at this, she's hiding him in the temple for 6 years while Athaliah rules. And you think about what's going on here. As bad as it is in the northern kingdom in Israel, now it's turned on its head, and Judah is even worse. Judah has a daughter of Ahab who has invaded this land by virtue of marriage, and it all comes back to one king who was a pretty good king in most ways, but was soft on fellowship, Jehoshaphat. It is Jehoshaphat who married his son to this woman, who caused this disaster. Little do we know what seemingly innocent steps we may take that would cause an absolute disaster later on. We stay away from the beginnings of sin and the edge of sin. You don't have to be right in the middle of it to commit an atrocity. Much of this is laid at the feet of a very good man otherwise, and that's Jehoshaphat. Now, as she hides him just when it seems that the godless have won. I mean, she's overthrown, basically, the whole empire of Judah. And now the kingdom of Israel is reigning in Judah. And I suppose the only reason she doesn't say, well, here, I have the kingdom, I'll give it back to you, to her relatives in Israel, is because she wants to reign. She'd rather reign in Judah than be a second-class citizen in Israel. That's all I can figure. She certainly wanted to reign so much that she's willing to kill her own grandchildren. So that's quite a bit of ambition there. Now, as we look at this, we ask the question, what was God doing all this time? And what's the answer? When it looks like it couldn't get any worse, David's ancestors, his descendants rather, are down to one. God's promise to the world looks in jeopardy. It's never in jeopardy, but it looked that way. This woman is reigning. She's rewarded for her murders by being able to sit as queen over Judah. What is God doing? What is the answer to that? Psalm 2:4 gives us part of the answer. Psalm 2 talks about the nations raging, the people plotting a vain thing, and the kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together. That sounds a lot like Athaliah's attitude. They take together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. That's what those people are saying. They're desperately wicked people. What is God doing? Look at verse 4. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. Now, it may be if there were righteous people of Judah around, they were wringing their hands and saying, oh, this country is going down the drain. It's never been worse. We've never seen it this bad. She's gotten them. She's going to come for us. We can't even practice our religion without being in grave danger. The worship of Baal has been instituted again. And all this, what is God doing? He laughs. Not the laughter that He's amused, but the laughter of mockery. As if to say, you think you can overthrow me? You really think this little ant down there won't be stepped on? You think you're going to succeed in this? He shall laugh, and then in the parallelism, the second part of verse 4, the Lord shall hold them in derision. He doesn't look at them and say, oh, how clever she is. How powerful she is. What a great woman she is. There's nothing great about her. The great woman is the one who gets no credit for politics. She just hides a baby, saves the baby's life. The one who thought she was great is one of the sorriest human beings who ever lived. I think that's pretty easy to understand. In chapter 33 at verse 10, Psalm 33 verse 10, it goes on to say, the Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He makes the plans of the peoples of no effect. What is that saying? It says you can plot, you can steal, you can kill, you can manipulate, you can throw your weight around, you can have power behind you and exert that power and get your way. But what's the end of it? You're going to be destroyed. You will be put down. Now, a parallel to this is Colossians 2. When you notice in Colossians 2 what went on at the crucifixion of Jesus, what a day that was. He's falsely accused. He's put through a kangaroo court that was not a fair trial. They bring every charge they can against him. They can't even get those to coincide. And then finally they just take him and say, admit it. Yeah, he admits what he is. He's going to come in the clouds and judge them. And says, that's all we need to know. And they take him to Pilate. They falsely accuse him. He's scourged and he's crucified. And the people who were on his side, the people who knew him as their Savior, went home absolutely dejected. The Jews, his disciples, are in an upper room behind closed doors because they're afraid the Jews will come for them next. The others are walking along and they're saying, what a horrible day. This is the worst day of our lives. We had thought, and we know this because of Luke 24 on the third day, we had thought he's the one who's going to rescue us. We had thought he was the Savior. We had thought he's the Messiah. He's dead. And there they are talking to him. They're talking, they're saying that to him. And you look at all this, Colossians 2 puts it in the proper perspective. In verse 14, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross, get this, having disarmed principalities and powers, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it. Therefore, let no one judge you in these regards. And what he's saying here and in so many other passages is Jesus was the victor on this occasion and they were the defeated ones who many later came and said, yes, we did this. We're pricked in the heart. What do we need to do to be on his side? What do we need to do to escape his wrath? That's the attitude. And so when you look at this, this is the way the people in the first century had to change their minds. We're going to see before very long, these people are going to have to change their minds too. And God was right all along. So when it looks like things are at their worst, just remember who's still raised from the dead. Remember who's still seated on His throne. Remember who's going to be victorious at last. Remember that He will conquer every single enemy, the last one of which is death itself. And that means He's going to raise everybody who's ever died, and they'll stand before Him in judgment. And then Athaliah will hear what He has to say to her. It's going to be an amazing scene. We just want to make sure we're on the right side when that occurs. Any comments on this? Steve?
You know, kind of going back to point four, what was God doing? Listen, you know, people today continue, where was God in all this evil that goes on and so forth? And of course, we're reminded in Romans 12, verse 19, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And throughout both the Old and New Testament, we're told God is aware of everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And He doesn't approve of the evil. Everything from Job to all the way through. And so, you know, even perhaps we should be tempted to say that, say, why did God intervene, or where was He in that? He knows.
That is an outstanding.
Our responsibility is just to be faithful.
Outstanding comment. And the attitude we should always have. You remember what happened when the Twin Towers went down, what people said about God? Remember what they said? Where was God when this happened? Why couldn't He have prevented this? He's either not there or He's asleep on duty to let this happen. It's all God's fault. And these are the very people who say, we don't want God interfering with our lives. You can't have it both ways. You just cannot have it both ways. If you want Him to interfere, then He's going to tell you what to do. Oh no, I don't want God to interfere. Unless it's with those sinners, not this sinner. Aren't you glad God rules the world instead of people? Any other comments? Yes, sir.
In other places, like in the early chapters of Isaiah, and other places that also a punishment for evil doing of the citizenry is poor leadership.
Poor leadership. A child shall lead them.
Yes,
that's excellent. Excellent comment. Any others? Matt.
You may be about to talk about this, but there's a detail in verse 3 that I think is this.
Verse 3?
Yes, where they hide Him in the temple. That's next door.
Yeah.
It's the next building over.
Yeah.
And that shows how little they were using it. So they knew she wasn't going in there, even though it's next door. It's just ready to hide.
She would never darken those doors. They had their own temple to Baal. And it's not long for this world at this point. But you're right. That's right. They weren't worried about her going in. Brother Bill.
David could still have the descendant reign, even if they'd killed the child, through Nathan, according to Luke 3, genealogy of Christ.
Yeah, I don't know if it would have been both, though. They need both in the both genealogies, if I understand it right. Anyway, I'll think about that. Any others? Okay. As you look then at verse 3, he was hidden with her in the house of the Lord for 6 years while Athaliah reigned over the land. So what you have here in this passage is the temple of the Lord that is stood. I think you can see some compromise on her part. She doesn't tear this temple down. That's to her lack of victory, her defeat, because if they don't tear it down, they're going to use it to have a place to keep him in, and he'll be safe there. And then in verse 4, in the 7th year, Jehoiada sent and brought the captains of hundreds of the bodyguards and the escorts and brought them into the house of the Lord to him, and then he made a covenant with them and took an oath from them in the house of the Lord and showed them the king's son. So, in verse 4, you have the 7th year of her reign. She's reigned for six full years. Jehoiada calls the commanders and the guards, and he makes a pact, and he reveals Joash. You notice in verse 4, he made a covenant with them, took an oath from them in the house of the Lord, and showed them the king's son. Then he commanded them, saying, this is what you shall do. And he divides them up into thirds. One third of you come on duty on the Sabbath, should be keeping watch over the king's house. One third will be at the gate of Shur, and one third at the gate behind the escorts. You'll keep the watch of the house, lest it be broken down. The two contingents of you who go off duty on the Sabbath shall keep the watch of the house of the Lord for the king. But you shall surround the king on all sides, every man with his weapons in his hand, and whoever comes within range, let him be put to death. You get too close to this fence and you're dead. You're to be with the king as he goes out and as he comes in. So the captains of the hundreds did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded. Each of them took his men who were to be on duty on the Sabbath with those who were going off duty on the Sabbath and came to Jehoiada the priest. And the priest gave the captains of hundreds of spears and shields which had belonged to King David that were in the temple of the Lord. The escort stood, every man with his weapons in his hand, all around the king, from the right side of the temple to the left side of the temple by the altar in the house. And he brought out the king's son, put the crown on him, gave him the testimony. They made him king and appointed him, and they clapped their hands and said, "Long live the king." Now that's a long reading, but it's one big unit. You have the bodyguards in verse 4. Who today does this remind you of when you see the personality who is the highest official in the land, and you see these men all crowded around him, protecting him and watching every which way and having their hands in a particular place? Who do you think of? The Secret Service. That's similar to what's going on here. They had no guns in their hands, but they had other weapons. Notice in verse 4, he made a covenant, took an oath, and showed them the king's son. They gave their word. He showed them the king's son. That must have been a glorious revelation for these people. And then he sets them in their positions. They surround him on all sides, verse 8. And then in 11, the escorts stand around him, protecting him. And in verse 12 in particular, he brought out the king's son, put the crown on him. Now, I don't know what was on Athaliah's head, but the crown is on this one's head. And gave him the testimony. That's what Deuteronomy 17:19 says. The king is to read every day. He's to read the testimony to know the will of God for him. And they anointed him. They poured oil on him. And they clapped their hands and said, "Long live the king." Now that sounds kind of like Britain there. They clapped their hands, "Long live the king." That's what they say there many times. And so here they are rejoicing because the one who has been reigning is now no longer reigning. The one who deserves to reign will be reigning. Okay, when you look at if you notice the notes, Jehoiada accomplishes the overthrow of the illegitimate ruler and establishes the right one in his place. He does it without having to kill nearly as many men as Jehu had to do. God used Jehoshaphat and Jehoiada to frustrate her plans, and you have the rebels who violate the law. Jehoiada will restore law and order. This is the same with Pharaoh when he wanted to destroy Israel. You see what happened? God overthrew Pharaoh instead. Saul wants to kill David. Saul dies instead. Herod wants to kill Jesus. Herod dies instead. Jehoshaphat brings them to the brink, and yet God takes care even of that contingency. Any comments? Okay. Now, in verse 13, when Athaliah heard the noise of the escorts and the people, she came to the people in the temple of the Lord. I wonder if this is the first time she's ever set foot in the place. She has no business here, really. When she looked, there was the king. She's the queen, she thinks, but there's the king standing by a pillar, according to custom. And the leaders and the trumpeters were by the king. All the people of the land were rejoicing and blowing trumpets. So Athaliah tore her clothes and cried out, "Treason, treason." Most grandmas, if they had gone in and saw their grandboy sitting up there, six-year-old, seven-year-old, he's seven-year-old now, grandson, sitting on that throne. You know what most grandmas would do? Pictures galore. Did I tell you about my grandson? You know what my grandson's doing? What about your grandson? My grandson is the king. That's what most grandmas would do. What does this one do? She cries, "Treason, treason," of all the gall. And what standard does she appeal to call this treason? She's implying that some injustice has occurred. What injustice has occurred when you give the rightful king his throne? What standard does she appeal to? Certainly not to God. I doubt she's heard anything from Baal. So what is her standard? I think just her personal view, like it is today for the most case. Then in 15, Jehoiada the priest commanded the captains of the hundreds, the officers of the army, and said to them, "Take her outside under guard. and slay with the sword whoever follows her. For the priest had said, do not let her be killed in the house of the Lord. So they seized her, and she went by way of the horse's entrance into the king's house, and there she was killed. I couldn't help but think, here is the nag who goes out the horse's entrance. But in Matthew 26:52, Jesus makes a comment to Peter. Those who live by the sword, die by the sword. That's how she lived, that's how she died. And then in 17, Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord, the king, and the people that they should be the Lord's people, and also between the Lord's people and also between the king and the people. And all the people of the land went to the temple of Baal and tore it down. We need to pause there and mention about three things in this section. First of all, you'll notice that it's telling us these people had a renewal of the covenant, verse 17. To renew the covenant means we're going back to the law that God originally instituted for the purpose of serving Him as He wishes. And nobody such as Athaliah had any business being part of that covenant. Number two, there's rest and peace in the land. When the evil are eliminated, then you have good folks left. When you have good folks left, you have the epitome of what good government should be. The ideal government is a good king who rules his people with a servant mentality. And when you have that, it doesn't get any better. The worst government is that of a monarchy, when you have a king who rules like it's all about him. They've just had that kind in Athaliah. Now, they should have this better kind with Joash if he listens to Jehoiada. For a while he does, then he stops. Then the third thing, there's the destruction of anything that would be inimical to or opposed to this proper reordering, and that is Baal worship. So you see in verse 18, they tore down the temple of Baal. So notice that while you've had in Israel these people who are worshiping the golden calves, but still saying they're worshiping the one true God. They're wrong, but that's what they're saying. And He's represented by these calves. It's the true God of heaven, but it's through these calves, and it's at different times and different places and all that. Here in Judah, of all places, they've gone so far that they're not even worshiping the true God, at least not in this temple. They're worshiping Baal, a false god. And then you notice also they killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars, and the priest appointed officers over the house of the Lord. So obviously two things are true. Baal has no reaction to this at all. He doesn't object. He doesn't shout. He doesn't cause lightning bolts to come down. Baal is a no-show all the way through this book. He never defends his honor. Then secondly, you see, Judah has been invaded. They've been invaded by this troop of people who have tried to overthrow the kingdom of God and set up one of their own, and they've just been defeated. They've been defeated by a little boy because a woman had the courage to save his life. Then in 19, he took the captains of hundreds, the bodyguards, the escorts, and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down from the house of the Lord and went by way of the gate of the escorts to the king's house. Then he sat on the throne of the kings. So all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet, for they had slain Athaliah with the sword in the king's house. The national nightmare is over. Notice, all the city is quiet. They've slain Athaliah. Be thankful for faithful, godly rulers. And also, Joash was 7 years old when he became king. Any more comments on any of this? Steve.
Kind of going back to Athaliah's response as far as done on treason when she saw Joash, you kind of wonder what she was thinking as far as this isn't somebody foreign, but it turned out this is a grandson that she missed. She didn't
kill. Excellent.
Probably the total shock.
Excellent. I think that is. She thought she was thorough. One exception made the difference. Any others? Okay. Now, I think verse 18, I think we've already talked about that. Yeah, verse 18. Notice the expression in verse 18. It says, they thoroughly broke in pieces. There are normal verbs that just state an action. There are other kinds of stems that give great emphasis, and this is one of those. You can break something. I break things all the time. I don't intend to, but I do. But this is when you take something and you absolutely demolish it. And you see these words that describe it. Crush, maul, shatter, smash to bits. Some versions even put smash to bits in there. This means you don't just break it. You destroy it. They absolutely took their wrath out on this temple. I love this verse. If you're going to destroy evil, do it right. Don't leave anything that remains of what it used to be. There's not a halfway measure where they say, well, you know, we could keep this and rent it out to visiting Moabites or something. Nothing like that. There's no link to the past. You know, we need to keep this for historical reasons. No, you don't need to keep this. It's a clean break and it's a total commitment. And I think about Exodus 32, verse 20. You remember something else they took, and they used this word. They absolutely smashed it. Remember what that was? The calf, Exodus 32, 20. It got similar treatment. Deuteronomy 12, verse 3. When you go into their land, here's your word. You do this to their altars. What did they do instead? They put an altar on every hill. That's not making a clean break with sin. That's still having one foot in the world and one foot in the kingdom of God. Well, then you get to the New Testament, and the same word that was used in the Septuagint here is used in the New Testament in Romans 16, verse 20, when it's talking about what God is about to do for the brethren in Rome. Romans 16, 20, and the God of peace will crush, there's our word, will crush Satan under your feet shortly. And then, adjoining that is, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you. So here you have a case where Satan himself is going to go through some major, major, major defeats. Okay, still, any comments on any of these? Okay. In chapter 12, in the seventh year of Jehu, Jehoash became king. So we have two sevens here. The last verse of chapter 11, Jehoash is 7 years old. Then in verse 1 of chapter 12, it's in the seventh year of Jehu. Jehoash became king and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Okay. What about that verse and Joash's faithfulness? There's something a little frightening in verse 2. What if it had said, Joash did what was right in the sight of the Lord, period. What if it said, Joash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all of his days? Oh, great. But he didn't say that. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. He has a wise mentor. But this is temporary and conditional obedience, not an obedience that is based upon God himself. Some man is directing him. He's listening to that man. Now, it's good to have mentors if you need some help in something to get advice and so on. Counsel determines conduct. If you accept the counsel, then that's the conduct you're going to pursue. So he has a wise counselor. He's going to engage in some proper conduct. But the implication is very dark here. That as soon as Jehoiada dies, and he's already an old man, there's going to be a different direction in this king. And that's exactly what we see. So, he reigns for 40 years. He's 7 when he starts. That may tell you something. In verse 3, but the high places were not taken away. You remember Jehoshaphat, a good king in most ways. Got rid of them totally at once, but they kept coming back. It was a notorious thing to try to get rid of all the high places where the people still sacrificed. It was illegal, it was unscriptural, but they still had problems with it in outlying areas. Joash said to the priest, and we'll have to go through this part rather quickly because we'll need to see the more complete edition of it in 2 Chronicles 24. But he dedicated all the money of the dedicated gifts, the census money. Each man was bringing half a shekel every year, you remember, Exodus 30. And the money that man purposes in his heart, the free will offerings and things of this nature. Bring those to the house of the Lord. Let the priests take it themselves, each from his constituency, and let them repair the damages of the temple wherever any dilapidation is found. And it was so by the 23rd year of King Joash that the priests had not repaired the damages of the temple. So the work's not being done. Sounds like Washington, D.C., doesn't it? The money keeps coming, keeps coming, keeps coming, and it seems like nothing ever gets changed. Well, that's the case here. So they hadn't repaired it. So King Joash called Jehoiada the priest. And he said, why have you not repaired these damages? Now don't take any more money. And said, I don't know what's going on here, but the priests were supported by some of these offerings. Are they holding on to that as their income and not giving what they need to repair the temple? I don't know, but it's a possibility. But in verse 8, he gets them to agree that they'll take no more money from the people nor repair the damages of the temple. He's going to turn to someone else to do it. So he took a chest, verse 9, bore a hole in its lid. He gets the people to understand that now we're on the up and up. This is going to be used for the purposes for which we're raising it. And so in verse 10, when they saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's scribe and the high priest came up and put it in bags and counted the money that was found in the house of the Lord. People gave when they saw that it was going to be used properly. And then in 11, they gave the money which had been apportioned. That means there was fiscal accountability. They did what they said they would do. And this is similar to Paul in 2 Corinthians 8, where he says, I will not go unless someone goes with me. And he holds this accountable for this money that's being spent. And he talks about the masons and stonecutters and various ones. And then in verse 15, they did not require an account from the men in whose hand they delivered the money to be paid to the workmen, for they dealt faithfully. These are faithful people. Choose someone you know to be honest, you don't have to watch his every move. And then in 16, the money from the trespass offerings and the money from the sin offerings was not brought into the house of the Lord. It belonged to the priests. Now, at this point, we're introduced to Hazael again. He's the thorn in the side. The one who killed Ben-Hadad, king of Damascus, is now still the king. He went up and fought against Gath. I don't know at this time whether Gath is still under the Philistines or is under Judah's control. I don't know. But he took it. Then he set his face to go to Jerusalem. We know that the amount of men he had with him here was a small number. Judah's going to have a large number, and it's not going to go well with Judah. So verse 18 says, Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the sacred things that his fathers, Jehoshaphat, and Jehoram, and Ahaziah, kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred things, and all the gold found in the treasuries of the house of the Lord, and in the king's house, and sent them to Hazael, king of Assyria. Then he went away from Jerusalem. So part of his humiliation, part of his punishment is, he gets wounded, his soldiers are slaughtered by the tens of thousands, and he has to pay tribute to Hazael. In verse 19, the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And his servants arose and formed a conspiracy and killed Joash in the house of the Millo, which goes down to Silla. That's some neighborhood of Jerusalem, I presume. For Josachar, the son of Shimeath, and Jehozabad, the son of Shomer, his servants struck him. So he died. They buried him with his fathers in the city of David. Then Amaziah, his son, reigned in his place. He doesn't get the regular honors that most kings would get. Now, any comments over this? That's a very quick perusal of it because, as I said, we need to see it more in 2 Chronicles 24. Any comments? Okay, let's just turn there and get a couple of things noticed before I haven't rung the first bell. Before the second bell rings, which is to happen shortly. Okay. In 2 Chronicles 23, we have the death of Athaliah. Chapter 24, Joash was 7 years old when he became king. He reigned 40 years. He tells his mother's name. Then in verse 2, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. Not necessarily out of love for God, but a godly influence of Jehoiada is moving him at this point. Jehoiada took two wives for him. He had sons and daughters. After this, Joash set his heart on repairing the house of the Lord. Now, we're told in verse 5, they were to gather money to repair the house from year to year. See that you do it quickly, he said, but they did not do it quickly. Their lack of zeal upset him. So he called Jehoiada, held him accountable, and he said, we need to have this done. For, verse 7, the sons of Athaliah, that wicked woman, had broken into the house of God and had also presented all the dedicated things of the house of the Lord to the Baals. So they had done some ransacking of the temple at the expense of the temple here. Verse 8, at the king's command, they made a chest, set it outside the gate. They proclaimed that you can bring this collection that Moses, the servant of God, imposed on Israel in the wilderness. Then verse 10, the honest handling here. All the leaders, all the people rejoiced, brought their contributions, put them into the chest until all had been given. And at this time they had an abundance, verse 11 tells us. And then in verse 12, the king and Jehoiada gave it to those who did the work of the service. They hired masons, carpenters, and others. And in 13, the workmen labored. The work was completed by them. They restored the house of God to its original condition and reinforced it. When they finished, they brought the rest of the money. They made articles, things to serve with, spoons, vessels of gold, and so on. And they offered burnt offerings in the house of the Lord continually all the days of Jehoiada. Verse 1 and verse 14 both emphasize that faithfulness and construction was going on during the time that Jehoiada lives. Now, the Lord willing, next week we'll have to see that in verse 15 he grew old and died. And things are going to change dramatically. Any comments before we leave? Okay, thank you very much for your very helpful comments this evening.